keep it alive through these lines I write. I keep it live cause I thrive on mic. Just blow your mind tonight. I'm so hyped, but it's no hype. From this height, it's direct hits on sight. I'm your type, lend me your ears to show you that there's something in me. I'm not giving up, I'm standing right here holding these days hostage, and I'll make this my year. We turning fear into love, and the love's in the air. I love doing this cause nothing compares, nothing can share that same type of feeling when you feeling them flares. They can't catch it, it's havoc. I rip to a tear, switch a scenario. My stereos, I leave them impaired. Variables start to change, and they're all in my range. I just gotta grab it, it's all mathematics. Every step is drastic, I make it fantastic. I'm trying to take your breath away, asthmatic.
This is live through the stereo. Go and let it blow, blow through the stereo. I'ma let them know, no through the stereo. Yo, here we go, go through the stereo, stereo. This is live through the stereo. Go and let it blow, blow through the stereo. I'ma let them know, no through the stereo. Yo, here we go, go through the stereo, stereo.
Yeah. Just nod your head with it, so explicit and vivid. Every image is intricate, intimate. I put my all into it, no scrimmage and no rules. I'm a pro tool, hear my heartbeat beat into the vocals. I'm so loco, lost my mind, oh no. It's ponderoso, dope so, no overdose cause it's dope. Yo man, this is house grown, mixed with some milestones. So I let the style flow, down like the Dow Jones. Bringing it with some foul tones, letting the crowd know we getting loud, so it's eardrum rudiments. Yeah, we bring it rude again. Move, little hooligan. Music for tuning in. Full time to the 10. I'm on my clock, like I told you. I'm doing this for dreams we pursuing.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Anti-Media Radio. Once again, with your host, Nick Burnaby, here on UCY.TV. Thank you all for tuning in, and glad to be back with you. Wednesday, we had a pretty awesome show, relatively unscripted, because we've been having a lot of guests on the show and taking up the whole radio show with guests talking about individual subjects. So on last Wednesday, we just kind of went out and talked about a bunch of different stuff, unscripted, and it kind of went all over the place, but I had a lot of fun, and hopefully everyone listening enjoyed it. But tonight, we have a couple guests lined up, and we're going to be discussing, first off, some recent news, some breaking news, and some stuff that we always go over, you know, foreign policy and the like. But we're also going to be talking about Columbus Day and the ongoing struggle with indigenous people all over the world, especially here in the U.S., all over North America, Canada, Mexico, Central America. I mean, you name it, there's constantly struggles going on with indigenous populations, being whether they're being exploited or taken advantage of by, you know, the people that are coming in and trying to take their resources or enslave them or convert them to their religion. You name it. I mean, it's just all kinds of different things going on. But first, I want to cover some quick news here because I know everyone always is depending on us to get the news out there. First off, there was a bunch of protests over the weekend, all over the world, in fact. In Germany, it was one of the largest protests that they've ever seen. In fact, some people are saying it's one of the largest they've ever had, but they've estimated that 250,000 people in Berlin alone, which is obviously the biggest city in Germany, to oppose the TTIP, which is their transatlantic trade pact, which is very similar to the TPP, but it's the version of the trade that is going on with Europe. Sorry, we had a little technical difficulty there. anyway, I'm back. So, you know, Europe is dealing with this huge trade agreement as well. And it's basically the version of the TPP. It's to create a trade pact with Europe. And once again, it is a containment measure against Russia and the East. But, you know, it's jam-packed full of secretive
agreements, and you know, France nearly walked away from the negotiations last week. I'm sure everyone heard about that. We briefly mentioned it here on the show. But I mean, obviously people in Germany are just completely not buying into it. 250,000 people in one city protesting, that's huge. That's enormous. Those are levels of shutting, you know, that's enough people to shut shit down legitimately, you know what I mean? And so that's what went on in Berlin. There was also TTIP protests in London, Amsterdam, all over the European Union. People are not really buying into this. Obviously, the TPP deal was recently finalized with the negotiation side of things. In about a month, in about 3 weeks from now, we're going to be able to see the full text of the TPP. Right now, we've been reliant on leaks, mostly from WikiLeaks, regarding certain chapters of the TPP. We're going to get full access to the text in about 3 weeks, and we're going to have 2 months to look at that text, and we get to see what's actually in it. There's going to be just a complete saturation of news stories about the TPP. So keep an eye out for that. Make sure you look for some really good sources. We're going to be covering it in depth on the anti-media. But we're expecting a lot of bad things to be coming out of this TPP, and you know, it's not hard to, you know, it's not hard to kind of disagree with that, because they're so damn secretive about it, you know. And when it's these corporate lobbyists and, you know, corporate representatives negotiating the TPP, I mean, it's not going to be surprising that we're going to see a bunch of really extreme measures in there that are going to, you know, maybe anger a lot of people that are just trying to look out for their own well-being, you know, and not trying to look out for Walmart's well-being or Amazon's well-being or any of these companies' well-being. We're trying to, you know, hopefully look out for our own. The TPP, what it does is it cuts the government out of the situation. Now, of course, people are like, yeah, the government sucks, and you know, the government isn't even representative of us anyway. But you know, we're talking about, you know, cutting the middleman out here, because right now the corporations have to lobby these governments, lobby these politicians to get them to do things for them. And, you know, that's bad enough. But the TPP, the TTIP, it cuts them completely out of the situation, where now these corporations are making up their own laws and making their own enforcement mechanisms, corporate tribunals, so they've been called. And that's, you know, just a really scary scenario. I think Jake can touch a little bit more on that before we move on to the next story here.
Hey man, we're talking about TPP outsourcing certain kinds of regulatory actions to corporate tribunals. Is that?
Yeah, we're just briefly covering the TPP. There's a huge protest this weekend in Berlin,
right,
and
yeah,
all over Europe.
Yeah, I actually was just reading another facet to TPP I didn't even know is. One of the industries, interestingly, that's going to benefit greatly from TPP is actually the meat industry, because the meat industry is seeing a lot of cutback in diets from, you know, veganism and vegetarianism and whatnot. And so what TPP is going to allow is it's going to allow more exposure in those other markets, but of course, without corporate regulatory oversight, the industry will not be subject to regulations regarding GMOs, hormones, and antibiotics, and all the crap that they put in the meat. So I just read that. I didn't even know. I think all of us are still trying to piece together the narrative that this TPP is bringing with it.
Yeah, it's just full of dark secrets. We're going to find out in a few weeks here what's really in it. So, you know, keep an eye out for that on the anti-media. I'm sure we're going to have a lot of coverage on that. The next story here with these protests is there was the latest incarnation of the Million Man March down in Washington, D.C., led by Farrakhan. And this year they were mostly focusing on police brutality. Obviously, it's a huge issue in the black community and in the entire country, in fact. With everyone's getting beat down by the cops. So that went down. Now, the thing about all these protests over the weekend, like I'd say, I don't know, there's probably 500,000 people all around the world protesting this weekend for various causes. There was very little media coverage of it outside of the alternative media. You know, the media doesn't want us to see these huge these huge acts of civil disobedience or civil unrest, whatever you want to call them. You know, there's all kinds of things going on. Now, another protest that was going on was over in Turkey, and it was a pro-peace protest, and people are out there calling for peace between the Turks and the Kurds, and a couple bombs went off, and there was roughly over 100 people dead. I mean, they still don't know how many people are for sure dead yet. I mean, well over 100 people. And, you know, nobody really knows who did it. The Turkish government is blaming some Islamist group. At first, people were saying it was ISIS. Other people say it may have been the Turkish government. A lot of the protesters are holding the Turkish government accountable for not providing adequate security, and then their reaction after the bombing was pretty horrible. In fact, they wouldn't allow ambulances in to take care of the hurt, and they started tear gassing people after they just got hit by these suicide bombers, you know what I mean? So the Turkish government is just up in it's knee deep in corruption and a bunch of very questionable practices, to say the least, going on over there in Turkey. I want to welcome our next guest on the show, because I'm sure Justin, you have a bit to talk about what's going on in Turkey as well, along with the Kurds and with ISIS. Maybe you want to touch on that real quick before we go on to what we actually have you on the show for.
Sure. I'll always talk about the Kurds. From the last numbers that I got from the PKK, that's the Kurdish Sheriff's Group, if you want to believe the Turkish government, they've got the death toll at 87. Like, confirmed, we have 87 names we know of people that died. They know that there's more, but that's how many they've 100% accounted for. Most of the Kurds, they either believe that it was the Islamic State doing it to achieve some kind of, to scrap any hopes of unity, or they believe that it wasn't necessarily the Turkish government, but it was elements within the Turkish government, particularly within their intelligence service, that really don't like the Kurds. And that, as crazy as that sounds, that's probably what we're going to find out happened. That's really what it looks like.
So. Now, there was another recent bombing of a Kurdish group of students in Turkey as well. And that was blamed on ISIS. And then, you know, that's when Turkey said, okay, you know what, now we're going to join the war against ISIS. But then they went and started bombing the Kurds, you know, and that was just, what the hell? You know, it's just one of those things like, what in the hell's going on? ISIS just blew up a peaceful protest that was all Kurdish students. Turkey blames it on ISIS, and then Turkey goes and drops bombs on the Kurds. I mean, it was just mind-blowing what they did there. Right.
And when that happened, the Kurds, the PKK, the same group, actually said, we don't think it was the Islamic State, we think it was the Turkish government. And everybody laughed at them, because it sounds insane. And now it's happened again. And it's giving more credence to their original claim, which, I mean, that would be a textbook false flag operation. I can't believe those words came out of my mouth, but that's what it looks like.
Yeah, and, you know, false flags are pretty common. Jake's on the call right now, and he wrote an article in the Anti-Media about 5 documented false flags. Now, you know, we're not including any of the common, the modern, you know, popular false flag theories, because those haven't really been proven. But there's plenty of false flags on the books that have actually been proven. And it's a common tactic. It's a very common tactic that a lot of governments use, and a lot of wars are started with false flags and things like that. So, you know, and I wouldn't doubt it a bit. The Turkish government is a very shady organization. They have their own deep state operation going on there. As you said, there's rogue elements within the government of the intelligence service. I mean, they're really bad. They recently were very repressive. With recent protests in Turkey, I think it was about a year and a half ago. And, you know, they have also, after the bombing, they shut down many, you know, they started shutting down parts of Twitter, started censoring social media. It's not the first time they've done that. However, the thing that is pointed out in this article here, and the article I'm referencing is called Hundreds of Thousands of Protests Globally Over the Weekend, Media Coverage Absent. One of the things that we point out here in this article is that I mean, the Turkish government basically gets away with doing these really repressive things, yet the U.S. government continues to be a huge ally of Turkey, you know, and of course they're a member of NATO, so they're kind of just allowed to get away with whatever the hell they want. Now, if a country that we consider belligerent, like if Iran were to do the same thing and, you know, carried on some of these same acts, I mean, it would be like, oh my God, this is media coverage 24 hours a day. But I don't think the New York Times or the Washington Post covered the fact that Turkey was shutting down Twitter or censoring social media. They just won't cover that stuff, you know. So it's up to us to cover this kind of thing, spread this information. The poor people of Turkey, especially the minority groups like the Kurds that are living within Turkey, are stuck in a really, really bad situation. I think the Turkish government is pretty unpopular within just regular Turkish people as well, because they're seen as a puppet of the West and things like that. So yeah, keep an eye on all that, because it's pretty bad. It's pretty bad, and so we're going to see a lot of unrest going on in Turkey, and it's going to continue to go on as long as that puppet government remains in place. But anyway, let's move on here a little bit. We got a lot of stories to cover. First, let me introduce our panel. Tonight we have our longtime co-host DB Schwartz on the call. What's up? What's up, DB? How you doing?
Nothing, man. Just, I think, perplexed as everybody else is about this Turkey thing and the censorship and then blocking the ambulances in. There's a lot more to the story, and I think Erdogan's scared shitless, and I'm pretty sure they're going to probably revolt when everybody figures out what happened.
Yeah, man. I mean, I wouldn't doubt it. There is a lot of fallout going on. I mean, there's even talk of the Saudi Arabian government collapsing soon. I mean, I don't know. There's a lot of things going on with our allies out there in the Middle East and all these Western puppet governments out there.
Well, when BRICS fully installs, we're not going to be able to prop them up anymore, so they have to see the writing on the wall. But unfortunately for them, they made their own bed.
Yep. We also have Manny Aguilar on the call. How are you doing tonight, Manny?
Hey, how you doing? Just had some people up there. Actually, they're still up there. Should be back sometime tomorrow from L.A. And they took advantage of the million man march, because immigration is a big issue. So that was a good platform to bring everything out and stuff like that. You know, I was really happy to hear one of them tell me about a lot of the tribes were there, you know, which I think is great, because today, Indigenous Day, stuff like that, while Jake Anderson is celebrating Columbus Day and DB Shorts, you know, kind of nice that we're going to be talking about Indigenous Day today, you know.
Yeah, man. Exactly. Yeah. The Million Man March was a nice, you know, unifying movement, nice big protest, very big tent. And that's I think one thing that can help us bring some progress. Let's get through the rest of this panel here. We're also joined by Jake Anderson. How are you doing tonight, Jake?
I'm good. A bit concerned about my audio. I don't know if I'm coming in and out for you guys. But short of that, I'm good. I'm I gotta admit, full disclosure, I'm kind of in the dark on this. I guess everyone is, the Turkish incident. I guess I'll wait to hear a better breakdown of it. I can't make heads or tails of it. I read Claire Bernish's article from the Pontiac Tribune, but that's some real I don't even know the word for it.
It's crazy, what? Man. It really is. And they're getting away with all kinds of horrible things. And like I said, they're NATO allies, so they get kind of that special treatment. We're also joined by Justin King from the Fifth Column and the Anti-Media. How are you doing tonight, Justin?
Doing great.
And I believe we're joined by Cassius. How are you doing tonight, Cassius?
Hey, man. I'm doing great.
Awesome. So let's get through a few more of these stories. There was another article posted on the Anti-Media. It was originally gone up. It had originally gone up on antiwar.com by Dan Sanchez. But it's called ISIS, Israel, Iraq, and Syria. It's all part of the plan. Now, this article, keep in mind, it's a really long article. It took me 25 minutes to read the whole thing. But he really breaks down this whole conflict going on right now in Syria. And it dates back to these neocon plans that were put in place in the 90s. And Bush really laid the groundwork in getting them started. and Obama has been a useful player in these plans. He's done nothing but allow them to keep continuing to unfold. And basically what this article breaks down here is that everything going on in Syria with the civil war is by design in a way, in the fact that we were trying to destabilize the Syrian government for a really long time. Now, ISIS isn't, I don't think that they exactly planned on ISIS being created, but as ISIS started showing signs of life, they kind of embraced it, you know, and they said, you know, okay, you know, we could use these guys to help destabilize the region, get rid of that government, you know, and it goes back to, I think, General David Petraeus, Wesley Clark kind of talked about it a long time ago, and when he talked about the seven countries we were going to overthrow. But, you know, these guys, it's been pretty public, the plans that they've had, the designs they've been having on this region, and it's all geopolitical. It's all, they're trying to just keep the hegemony going and keep the petrodollar alive and all that stuff. And
I was just going to say, I think those days are coming to a swift end. It's kind of been known on the internet, if you've kind of looked around, that the Federal Reserve was undergoing a transition, we should say. And they went from .org to .gov. I don't know if anybody picked up on that, but pretty good chance we have something major happening right now underneath our noses.
Well, there's a huge, you know, huge things going on right now with Russia getting involved in Syria. And it's kind of thrown a wrench into the West's, you know, designs on the region. I think that they didn't plan on having Russia getting involved. And, you know, all the stuff we've been doing over there in Syria, it's been kind of secretive, right? You know, we've been covertly funding all these people. And now they're kind of, you know, now you see today on the New York Times where they said, oh, well, now it's becoming a proxy war in Syria between the U.S. and Russia. Yesterday on the Washington Post, same exact headline. Oh, is it becoming a proxy war between Russia and the United States in Syria? Well, yeah, I mean, that's what we've been saying since like 2011 when this stuff first started. You know, it's been long. We've long known that Syria is an ally of Russia. We've long known that the U.S. has been trying to overthrow the government of Assad. I mean, in 2013, Obama was very open about that. He tried to convince the American people that we need to go start that war, you know, and just go directly overthrow the government just like we did in Libya, you know. And you know, at that time in 2013, the American people were like, no, we're not going to let that happen. We're war weary. We're not going to go let you overthrow another government. You know, you guys already did what you did in Libya, and look how that turned out. So I think the people were kind of like, no, we don't want that. And then ISIS came around, and then it was a great excuse for these guys to get back involved in Iraq, and now they're bombing in Syria as well. And, of course, the U.S. maintains that it's not directly trying to overthrow the Assad government, but at the same time they're publicly admitting that their long-term goal is regime change in Syria. Russia has stated previously that they don't want to see the Assad government go because it's their ally, for multiple reasons, and of course it all goes back to, in many ways, oil and you know, things like that. There's a great article on Mint Press News about the pipelines and how these oil pipelines play a role in what's going on in Syria. If anyone's interested in that, I suggest you Google it. Very, very in-depth. We had Minar on the program about a month ago, and she talked all about it. It's very, very frightening to see that our leaders are willing to allow 250,000 people in Syria to die just to maintain our geopolitical strongholds and our geopolitical designs on those regions. So that's something to keep an eye out on. And like I said, the article on the anti-media, ISIS, Israel, Iraq, and Syria, it's all part of the plan. Probably the best article I've ever read on the entire situation over there. And so make sure you guys go over and read that because it's very, very informative. Just want to get through a little bit more of the news here. As far as the bombing of the Doctors Without Borders hospital, that's still ongoing. The U.S. has now offered to rebuild the hospital. Doctors Without Borders said no because they're not going to take that as an answer to what they did. They're also still pushing for independent investigation, but just to be honest and realistic about it, that's probably not going to happen. The U.S. pulls the strings for all these international organizations like the U.N. and, you know, those kind of things. So it's very unlikely that the U.N. is going to find the U.S. guilty of war crimes. But, you know, to be honest, it probably was a war crime.
Obama is going to impeach himself. That's what we should expect.
Exactly. And the conservatives would love it because he's so weak on foreign policy. You know, he hasn't overthrown any governments. anyway,
he's a constitutional lawyer. He knows the boundaries.
So another great article from Dan Sanchez on the anti-media is about how, you know, the Doctors Without Borders may have been bombed because of the fact that they've been helping, you know, because they don't discriminate against who they're helping. You know, even if you're Taliban, even if you're Al-Qaeda and you're injured in the field, they'll take you in, they'll give you medical care, and then they'll release you back out. You know, and so the Afghan government had raided the hospital several months ago, so they knew damn well where the hospital was at. And so, you know, there's a very good chance that the bombing of that hospital was retribution for the fact that the Doctors Without Borders is helping treat terrorists. But here's the thing. As this article mentioned, the article is titled "Medical Care for Terrorists Will Get You Bombed by the U.S. Unless You're Israel." Israel has done the same thing as far as helping Al-Qaeda fighters with medical care. As long as they're fighting against the Syrian government, you know, the Israelis will help Al-Qaeda, you know, if they're hurt, they'll help them get medical care, and then they'll release them back over into Syria so that they can go continue fighting the Syrian government. So, you know, there's another great article there on the anti-media. Make sure you read that because it kind of really shows you that there's really gray areas here with this foreign policy. You know, it's like, is Al-Qaeda our enemies? Because that's what they tell us. But why do we allow our allies to give them medical care and, you know, let them fight? You know, and so it really draws kind of a hypocritical line there. And it's not really surprising coming from the U.S. government because that's kind of what continues to go on. Anyway, with all that stuff being through, let's talk about Columbus Day. Let's talk about the Indigenous Peoples Day. Let's talk about what people are dealing with, you know, because there's just so much. Indigenous people, we all know Columbus came here, and if you paid attention in elementary school and throughout public schooling, you know, Columbus was a hero that discovered America, and he was a great guy. And if it weren't for him, you know, this place would still be filled with a bunch of savages and all that stuff. And this is the storyline that we're all told in public schooling. I know I was told that, and I believed it for a long time, too, until I started doing my own research. And then I started realizing, oh, damn, Columbus wasn't that great of a guy. He was an asshole. You know, he did a lot of bad things. So first off, let's go around the panel here and just briefly – I want everyone to tell us what they think about Columbus, what they think about this whole situation about Europeans coming to the U.S. or, sorry, not the U.S., coming to the Americas and doing what they did, because we all know how it turned out. We all know who got the short end of the staff there. I just want everyone to let us know how they feel. So I'm going to go in order of my panel here. DB, first, let's go to you. What do you think, man?
He's a genocidal, murderous asshole, dude. I mean, that's the only way you can put it. A lot of people are convinced that he kind of wiped out the Native Americans, although that happened a lot after him. But really what he did was he had legitimized the slave trade, because if you look back at history, where he hit first, which is South America, and then the Bahamas and that kind of area in the Caribbean, just got overloaded with African slaves. So we have him to thank for that at the very least.
Manny, you're next up.
Well, that's a bad thing, you know. I mean, obviously, you know, he was raping, you know, basically his soldiers were raping a lot of these young kids, you know, he was passing young girls around to all his men and stuff like that, you know, coming from the Spain crown to Mexico and stuff like that. And it's already bad enough when they brought us all their religion and all this bullshit, you know, and stuff like that. So it's kind of very offensive, you know, when here, you know, we're trying so hard to, you know, get somebody a good holiday, like, say, Cesar Chavez, a federal holiday, yet we can't do that, but yet nobody had a problem with celebrating Columbus Day for all these years, you know?
Yeah, it's hypocritical, man, you know? And, I mean, Martin Luther King Day is not even a federal holiday yet, you know? But yet we sit around and celebrate a guy like Christopher Columbus that came and wreaked a bunch of havoc. Justin, you're up next.
I think there's a little bit of historical relativism that happens. Like, when we look back at what he did, it was genocide, dude. There's no doubt about that. It's also common at the time, some of it, but I'm going to have to kind of agree with DB. What he did with the slave trade, that set the tone for the next 400 years, 500 years, and I think that's his biggest crime. A lot of the other stuff that he did, it was common at the time. It wouldn't have been looked on as something evil at the time, but then that, it was evil. He knew it was evil. He knew it was wrong. I think that's his biggest, the biggest thing that we can lay at his feet.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you and DB, man. It's just amazing what he did in a bad way. And go ahead, DB.
I was just going to say, man, it's called District of Columbia / Columbus for a reason. These guys still subscribe to that entire doctrine. And they're still, honestly, on Manifest Destiny. I guess the next step is Asia.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's a lot of backlash I saw today on social media. I think people are pretty much, you know, the whole myth of Christopher Columbus being this hero and all this stuff. And yeah, I mean, he did brave the seas and he came all the way over here. But all he did was open up a channel for imperialism, and they just came and jacked everybody's land, kicked everybody out, raped, pillaged, killed everybody. You know, and so I think people are seeing through that now. It seems like last year it was like, oh, damn, there's a lot of people that are questioning Columbus Day. This year it was like, everyone's like, let's just get rid of Columbus Day altogether. I mean, this idea is really becoming really mainstream, and I think people are finally starting to see the injustice here. And as Justin mentioned, it's been this 400 or 500 year legacy that continues on to this very day, man. It's still going on. We're going to get into that a little bit in a few minutes once we get through this panel. Cassius, you're up next. What do you think, man?
Well, I think that what we're presented with right now is an opportunity to make history right. We know what Christopher Columbus actually did. We just reviewed that, and what we're functioning to do right now is to make history right. So with an opportunity like this, Columbus Day, social media, you know, we're making it right, and we're changing the culture and the perception of Christopher Columbus. You've seen the change of attitude in just 1 year. So I think this is a great thing we're doing by recognizing what his legacy really was, and now that's what we can do in the aftermath of Columbus. And I think it's representative of the beliefs that elitist people subscribe to. The fact that Columbus Day is revered like this and celebrated, you know?
Yeah, man. Great point. Jake, what do you think?
I agree with what everyone said, and particularly your post on Facebook earlier. I mean, I'm a big proponent of reparations across the board. Certainly. Two quick points here. One, my favorite meme of the day that I saw was people looking at Columbus's ships coming in, and one, I guess native remarks to the other, they're not sending their best, they're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people. And of course, that's an echo of what Trump said of immigrants, but applying it to Columbus's people, the invaders. There's definitely seems to be a sea change here in terms of people, you know, it's beyond cliched at this point, but, you know, the problem is, and you pointed out earlier, is that no one's making the connection, the direct connection, that what Columbus represents is still very much alive, and
the kind of nausea associated with American exceptionalism and Manifest Destiny is still happening. It's just, we've just exported it to a different part of the world. I think you guys probably know who Patton Oswalt is, right?
Yeah, the comedian.
Yeah, I think he tweeted earlier today regarding Columbus, and I can't remember the whole tweet, and I'll tell you why for a reason, but he called him an opportunistic creep. And I tweeted at him, I think by opportunistic creep, you mean genocidal mass murderer / rapist. Sorry to bring up semantics. And his tweet is, he took it down. he deleted the tweet. I don't see it up there anymore. So I think I got, I think that's my claim for fame today, is I got Patton Oswalt to delete a tweet.
Well, hey, man, that's good for today. So I got a little bit of an agenda here tonight. So first we're gonna talk with Justin King regarding some modern struggles that are going on with Native Americans, because we know that they've been put through this plight ever since the moment Columbus set foot on North American shores, whether we're in the Caribbean, whatever. As soon as he found the Americas for Europe, there's been a chain of events that have basically created this horrible, horrible scenario for Native Americans. Everyone thinks, oh, it's over now. Now they have their casinos. What are they bitching about? You know, I literally hear people say that shit. But it's not true, man. Indigenous people in the U.S. and Canada are still going through a lot of hardships. And then after that, we're going to go to Manny to talk about what's going on with the indigenous people down in Mexico. So first off, I want to start with you, Justin, because one of the most recent stories that comes to mind with me was the EPA spill in the Animas River up there in Colorado. And, I'm sure everyone heard about it. The EPA, helped whatever they did out there. They were trying to remediate some old mining operations, and they accidentally spilled a bunch of waste into the river. But it ended up going and poisoning a bunch of the Navajos' drinking water and a lot of their crops water, the stuff they use to water their plants. And, but Justin, what can you tell us about the ongoing environmental disasters that Native Americans are still dealing with to this day?
Well, there's literally hundreds. I mean, there's everything from that to the Oak Flats to, the people up at Pine Ridge are still having issues.
And even the Keystone Pipeline, right?
Right, right. And, the Lakota have basically said that, that's not going to come through. They're prepared to blow it up, is what it sounds like. So we'll see, and that is a very... Historically, that's a very militant tribe. When stuff like this happens, they are always the first ones to engage in direct action. And this is going to go right through their neck of the woods. So I see there definitely being some conflict there. But anytime this happens, it always has to do with some form of natural resources, whether it be uranium or oil or coal or gold. That's what it's about. It's about something in the ground. And, these Native people, they've lived in these areas. It's their home. A lot, the Black Hills, they're sacred. I mean, this is not something that they're ever going to give up fighting for. But what the U.S. government has started doing is just doing a delaying tactic where they say, okay, they put it in the court system. They let it sit there. They file briefs. Meanwhile, the mining's going on. When the mining's done, they say, okay, we're sorry. You can have the land back, and here's a check. And then everybody in the tribe gets a check for a couple $1,000s. That's basically the stance that they've taken.
I've been reading some stuff on the Navajo Nation, and there's a lot of uranium mining going on there. And so a lot of the time, like you said, it's like, okay, here's your land back. Here's a check, but now there's still people getting cancer from all this uranium poisoning going on in the watering systems and the environment.
Right, right. I mean, they don't really do a great job of maintaining the land. They don't try to use the least invasive method of getting to whatever it is they're trying to get to. They go in and they destroy it. And it's something that Native people have dealt with now since the United States existed. I mean, it's become a fact of is a very weird relationship with Native people in the U.S. government, with the federal government. And there are some winning areas. I think the biggest news that got overlooked that is there's a federal act that went into effect that now allows tribal police on reservations to arrest non-tribe members for domestic violence. See, the way it worked before this act was if you weren't a tribal member, they couldn't really arrest you. They couldn't really do anything to you. So if your wife was a member of the tribe and you beat her on tribal property, on the reservation, they couldn't really do anything. They couldn't arrest you. And then the local government, you know, right outside of the reservation, didn't have jurisdiction over the crime. So you couldn't do anything to this person. The federal government has finally remedied that, and a pilot program went into effect in Arizona. Very successful. And so now tribal police are going to have that ability. And it's stuff like that where we're actually making gains, where Native people are making gains in actually being able to control sovereign territory that belongs to the tribe.
That's awesome, man, and it's glad to I'm glad to see that they're gaining more and more rights, you know. And there was another story recently about how they're now allowed to grow cannabis on all Native American reservations across the U.S. There was another recent story we covered on the anti-media about a tribe up in the Dakotas that is opening a cannabis resort, and that's that's pretty. A pretty cool development, you know, as far as I'm concerned. One thing I've noticed about this reservation situation, you know, it really seems like, of course, the Native Americans at one time controlled the entire continental, you know, the entire both North and South America, the entire continent. You know, they had the whole thing. When the settlers came over, they took the land. They kicked him off all the farmland because at the time, you know, that was the prime land. You know, it was like, okay, we'll kick him off the farmland, send him up into the hills where nobody wants to live, you know, and we'll just leave him be up there. And then as technology developed, they started realizing, oh, shit, we need uranium and we need all these other things. And then they realized, damn, we put the Native Americans where the other resources are at too. You know, and it's so like not only did they get kicked off of the prime farming lands a long time ago, but now it's like oh well, now we want to go take your resources on the land that we thought was shitty, and that's the reason we gave it to you. Now we want to go take that stuff too, you know. And to me, it's just like, man, it's like constantly, it's a constant battle. They're always getting the short end of the stick. And I think there's one thing that I've noticed is so many people think the plight is over. So many people think Native Americans are fine. They got it easy now. They get money from the government. And they've got reservations. All this shit. What can you tell us about that, man? Is that true, or you know, is there more to the story?
It's partially true. If your family gets off the reservation, if you marry a non-Indian, for example, you know, you're still entitled to a lot of the Native trusts. Okay, I mean, I am a perfect example of that. I mean, you look at me; I am a white guy. Okay, I'm a member of the Creek. The Muscogee Creek tribe, they paid for me to go to college. However, if I was on a reservation, I wouldn't have even had the money to get to the college. So there's a huge gap. I mean, your average, you know, the per capita income on a reservation, it's something ridiculous. I think the new figures are just below like $9,000 a year or something like that. That's insane. To live on $9,000 a year. And the amount of poverty that's on the reservations is staggering. It's insane. Once a family can get off the reservation, even a little bit, their life starts improving immensely. But it's hard to do, especially in the areas around reservations. The white people don't really care to hire Indians. they don't have any interest in it. So they have to move a great distance. Occasionally they can take advantage of getting out to Oklahoma State, where the tribes struck deals. Most tribes have deals with Oklahoma State where they can go to college for 4 years for free. I mean, like it's paid for. Just go show up, get good grades. And those education programs are helping immensely. But there are reservations that are left out of that. You know, there are whole nations and tribes that don't have programs like that. And those nations and tribes are hurting bad. Pine Ridge, perfect example. You know, I said it's historically a very militant area, the hotbed of American Indian Movement activity. And they're, these are the guys who shoot the FBI agents when they show up. They don't mess around. That is one of the least economically viable reservations out there. I mean, and we're talking about just a few thousand dollars a year to live on it. And, you know, most of us can go through that in 2 months. So.
Yeah, man, it's really sad. I've witnessed it firsthand. Down here in Southern California, we have a bunch of Native American tribes and reservations. And, man, you drive through and you can see the poverty. You know, you can see what's going on there. The ones that don't have casinos are in really, really bad shape. And even the ones that do, that are way out in the middle of nowhere, you know, no one goes to those casinos, and they're in really bad shape too. And, you know, this is all, it all traces back to what our government put the people through a long time ago when they just uprooted them all and moved them places that they weren't, you know, they moved them to all these places, took all the land, took all the profitable places and kind of just stuck them with what they, you know, what they thought was pretty much the worst deal that they can give them. And you still see the effects of it today. And the problems aren't gone. The problem, you know, they may put them out in the middle of nowhere, up in the mountains where you can't see them. But that doesn't mean the problems are gone. People are still dealing with a lot of issues. There's never been full reparations. Same thing with slavery and the black population in the United States. There's never been full reparations. Sure, they've issued apologies and things like that. But you know, you can wipe your ass with an apology. You know, I want to see some action.
One of the movements that I saw kind of going on was this massive petition that they were going to try to get Bank of America to pay back reparations. I guess they were originally the Bank of England or something, believe it or not. So that was from the 20th anniversary of the Million Man March. So there's movements going on now.
Yeah, I mean, it really seems like people are waking up to this, the indigenous plight. A lot of the news stories that are about Native Americans get a lot of traction right now. We recently covered one regarding Oak Flat because John McCain helped strike a deal with this Australian mining company to sell out some of Oak Flat to this mining company, and a lot, and it's considered sacred lands to some of the Native Americans in the area. And so John McCain went and he was doing a PR stunt at the reservation with some of the elders or whatever. And a bunch of these young activists, these young Native American activists, literally chased him off the reservation. Him and his entourage had to go off running and drive, haul ass out because, you know, these young guys just aren't taking it no more. They're done. They're not dealing with these assholes anymore. John McCain is enemy number one, you know, to some of these guys. So, I mean, it is gaining traction. I'm glad about that. I'm glad to see Columbus Day taking the beating that it is, and I think it is helping us raise a bit of awareness. Now, before we move on to Mexico and Latin America, Justin, do you know anything about what's going on in Canada? Because I know Canada has their own set of issues with their indigenous population and the Canadian government.
They have a huge issue with they call them First Peoples, disappearing. Particularly women. That seems to be at least the one that caught my eye. You know, they have the same territorial issues that natives here in the U.S. do, but that's something that we haven't seen in the U.S. in quite a long time, where it certainly appears that natives in Canada have been targeted for basically rape and murder. That's what it appears to be, is that they're literally being snatched up. That's not something that we've really had to deal with in the U.S. for quite some time, not on a scale like it's happening up there. And there's a concerted effort now to end that. And a lot of what the tribes up there are doing aren't not exactly legal, so I don't know how much I want to get into it, because I don't even know how far they're willing to take it, but they're preparing their own methods of defending themselves. So I think that's going to be the biggest thing, you know. And they've had some showdowns with the Mounties up there over territorial issues, especially dealing with the tar sands. And the Mounties, they behave the way U.S. cops do. You know, they tear gassed everybody and beat everybody up. So they mirror, except for the disappearances. That's a uniquely Canadian thing that we haven't seen here in probably 100 years.
Yeah, there's thousands of First Nations women that have just gone completely missing. And, you know, supposedly no one knows what's happening to them. I mean, we can all imagine what's going on, and it's probably not very good. But yeah, as you mentioned, there's a huge, huge standoff with the tar sands, and you know, it's a huge oil mining, or not oil, but it's this type of fossil fuel that they're extracting out. It's really resource intensive, causes a huge amount of pollution, costs a lot of resources to extract. And also there's a lot of resistance in Canada to the Keystone Pipeline as well that I've read about, and they don't want the pipeline being built because it's got to go through some native lands in Canada, and then also it's going to come through native lands here on the U.S. side of things. I remember getting into this big argument last year when Obama came and visited San Diego. He was here this weekend as well, but last year when he came, we were down there kind of welcoming Obama to San Diego with some protest signs. I know my sign was an anti-drone sign, but I got into an argument with these conservative guys down there that were these pro-Keystone Pipeline protesters and stuff, and I was kind of asking them, you know, how do you guys feel about property rights and that kind of thing? Oh, yeah, we agree with property rights. Property rights shouldn't be violated. And I said, well, you know that the Keystone Pipeline is violating property rights. They're using eminent domain to take land not only from Native Americans, but also from farmers and ranchers and other just landowners up there in the up in the Northwest and down in the Midwest and all those regions where they're going to try to build this pipeline. So, and then they made the argument, well, sometimes it's okay. You know, sometimes it's okay to take other people's property and things like that. You know, so it was just clear to me that they had really no ground to stand on ideologically or anything like that. So, there's huge disputes going on both in the U.S. and Canada. Now I want to bring Manny into the conversation here because Manny has some firsthand experience and knowledge about some of the indigenous struggles down in Mexico and Latin America. So first off, I want to just talk a little bit about San Quentin first. San Quentin is a farming community just south of San Diego down in Baja California in Mexico. And it's a place where they've been shipping in a bunch of indigenous people from central Mexico to come work the farmlands. Now, coincidentally, maybe not coincidentally, these are corporate, you know, factory farms that are run in most times by American corporations that have taken advantage of NAFTA, which is a trade agreement from the 90s passed under Bill Clinton, to basically, you know, they use NAFTA to take advantage of almost what would be considered slave labor down in Mexico. And down in San Quentin, they're shipping in these indigenous guys, promising them a bunch of these awesome perks. But when they get there, they're more or less kind of conscripted into working these farms. They're making less than $5 a day. They don't even have a pot to piss in. They don't have sanitary conditions. There's rats running around their camps. And they're just dealing with horrible, horrible conditions. And now this is especially relevant today because, as Jake mentioned earlier in the show, we're now turning our American exceptionalism and our manifest destiny outward with the TPP, and we're taking it to Asia. And so Asia is about to get the wrath of what Mexico has already felt with NAFTA as far as, you know, the exploitation of labor. The TPP is about to do that to a bunch of countries in Asia as well. But anyway, Manny, can you tell us a little bit about what NAFTA has done to the indigenous community in Mexico?
Well, NAFTA has really devastated, you know, the whole country because, you know, like, for instance, when you talk about Native Americans, a lot of Native Americans in the United States, once the border went up, a lot of them got stuck on that site. So, you know, there's you know, in San Diego County especially, you know, like that. And, of course, right now, the indigenous are fighting, which the Zapatistas are the biggest people that have been fighting for dignity, the wages and stuff like that. Now, a lot of people don't talk about this, but this is one of the biggest problems we're having. You know, we've only had one indigenous president. The first president was an indigenous, you know, Benito Juarez. Ever since that, you know, blame France and blame Spain is one of the things that nobody talks about, you know, and I'm kind of glad that we're talking about indigenous people because it gives me a chance. Right now, the indigenous people, we're fighting the Mexican that is not full indigenous like myself. Like, for instance, I'm brown because I'm full indigenous. A lot of these Mexicans are mixed in with French or they're mixed in with Spanish, and basically it's the whites are ruling our country right now and stuff like that, and letting the army, which happens to be indigenous people, and a lot of the cops are indigenous people, letting them do the dirty work. You know, that's what NAFTA has done to us down in Mexico. Yeah.
Yeah, man. I've noticed that too in my visits down there. I've seen it firsthand, and it's pretty horrible. There's a indigenous president down in Bolivia by the name of Evo Morales. We have a story on the anti-media about him right now. Just went up. I think it was the last story of the day that we posted. According to some leaks from WikiLeaks, it shows that as of 2007, the U.S. was actively planning on supporting a military coup of his country and or even assassinating him. And this is all part of a new book called The WikiLeaks Files, The World According to U.S. Empire. And it's mostly based on WikiLeaks diplomatic cables that were leaked by, of course, Chelsea Manning. But this guy, Evo Morales, he's a very strong leader down in Latin America, and he's been very resistant to U.S. economic interests. In fact, he's nationalized a lot of the natural resources, including the fossil fuel industry. He kicked the DEA out of the country several years ago, and coincidentally, since then, cocaine production has plummeted drastically. And so he's been a thorn in the side of the Monroe Doctrine. That is basically what it's the ideology, the philosophy that the U.S. uses to dominate basically every country in the Western Hemisphere. And there's a lot of countries out there right now that are pretty resistant to the Monroe Doctrine. Of course, the most long-standing examples would be Venezuela and Cuba. And, you know, we all see how they're treated by our government. But there's a very much reinvigorated movement now in Latin America to resist the Monroe Doctrine and to not fall under the sphere of influence of the United States. And so it turns out that basically any country that does that, any country that says, hey, look, we don't want to do the U.S.'s bidding in our country, we don't want to allow their corporations to come in, monopolize on our natural resources, we don't want Nestle to come take our water tables and all that. Well, it looks like the U.S., whenever that happens, they basically say, okay, well, let's get ready to overthrow this government. You know, and so that's a huge problem, and it kind of goes to show how the U.S. really exerts its military might over the top of the interests of indigenous communities in Latin America. So, I mean, the U.S. isn't only causing this problem here in the U.S. with the Native American people within U.S. borders. We do it all over Latin America as well. And, you know, a lot of the counter movements, Manny, you're from Guerrero. You're from a state where there's a bunch of these autonomous movements going on. You know, the U.S. doesn't look kindly upon these things because they see it as a threat to the Monroe Doctrine and a threat to our monopoly over the politics in Latin America. What can you tell us? I mean, we only have about a minute left. What can you tell us about these autonomous movements going down in Mexico right now? Why is it happening, and what can we learn from it?
Well, right now it's because our education system, they want to teach people more uneducated we are, the better for the government, you know, and that's why there's normal were killed and stuff like that, and now our women are having to take the front line because they have nothing else to die for, you know what I mean, and stuff like that, so they're willing to die for justice, and I'm kind of really glad about that, you know.
Yeah, man, I agree. There's women out there on the front lines in Mexico right now because the men are too tied up working these slave jobs, or they're already locked up, or they're already being preoccupied with other things. Of course, the students were kidnapped recently in Mexico, 43 students. It's been a year now. Still no answers to that equation. But there's hope in Mexico. People are rising up, man. There's revolutionary fervor growing down there. Look into it. Look into the autonomous movement of Mexico, the Zapatistas. Keep an eye on the anti-media for other news about Native Americans. Thank you all for tuning in. Justin, thanks for joining us. Manny, appreciate it as always. Everyone else on the panel, peace out, everybody. Catch us 5 days a week, the Anti-Media Radio here at UCY.
Buenas noches, everybody.
I'ma let them know through the stereo. Yo, here we go, go through the stereo.